78%. Wind is calm. Sunshine, a blue sky, 69 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have been devouring a really remarkable novel called In All Good Faith. This is a novel that is set during the Great Depression. And in some respects, one of the most remarkable things about this novel is that it is so engrossing and ultimately inspiring, even though it is set against the backdrop of almost unimaginable pain, against the backdrop of the massive economic devastation of the Depression. And only someone who lived through that time could possibly know what it felt like to be part of such a terribly painful era. But it is almost as though Liza Nash Taylor was alive during the Great Depression. I know for a fact that she was not, but she writes about it with an incredibly vivid attention to detail, and our hearts just ache for the characters in her novel and what they are experiencing. And we are also inspired by their resiliency, their determination to go on, to innovate, to find new pathways forward to a better tomorrow. And it all feels incredibly real and authentic. The book is published by Blackstone Publishing, and it comes on the heels of an earlier novel that features some of the same characters, that previous novel called Etiquette for Runaways, this one called In All Good Faith. Liza Nash Taylor, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hello, Greg. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all the nice things you said about my novel.
it's really quite extraordinary, and my morning show listeners probably tire of me saying this, but I am actually not someone who reads a lot of fiction. It's not what, generally speaking, trips my trigger the way nonfiction does. But in some respects, I think one of the reasons why I connected so powerfully with your novel is because you have such a close attention to the historical reality in which these characters are living in 1931 and 32. Could we maybe find out a little bit? I think this earlier novel was maybe set in years just before that, but obviously you must have had some fascination with the Great Depression in order to want to craft a novel set during that painful time in our history. What did you know about the Great Depression even before you began working on this book?
That's a good question. My father grew up during the Great Depression, and he didn't talk about it, but I know growing up he would we would get punished if we left a light switch on, or he was very much into conserving and saving, and I think a lot of people who lived through it have had that mindset. Two books that really helped me sort of get a personal feel for this period were Studs Terkel's nonfiction book, Hard Times, where he interviews a lot of people who lived through the Depression and their and writes about their experiences. And then I found a personal diary of a man called Benjamin Roth, who was a banker and lost his job and his house. And what is most heartbreaking about that diary is that when he started writing it sort of after the stock market crash in 1929, he had no idea how long it was going to go on or how bad it was going to get. Much like, you know, what we've been going through with the pandemic. When it began, nobody knew. We thought we'd be finished with it by now. But those two books really gave me a very personal insight into that time.
Well, that really rings true in the way that you have written this book. I have not read the previous novel, and one of the things I want to say is I fully enjoyed this novel, even without having looked at etiquette for runaways. It might be helpful to our listeners to know at least a little bit about that previous book and the ways in which it kind of sets the stage for at least one of the characters in this new novel, In All Good Faith.
Yes. I call In All Good Faith a standalone sequel, meaning you wouldn't have had to have read the first novel for this one to make sense. Etiquette for Runaways is set in 1925. Both novels are set at the house where I live in rural Virginia called Keswick Farm. And the first one finds May having been kicked out of college, running when her father, who's a moonshiner in Albemarle County, Virginia, is arrested. She goes on the run to Jazz Age New York and Paris, and the Paris part of the story was inspired by Josephine Baker's debut in 1925 in Paris. So the end of that story leaves May having made, May Marshall, the main character, having made some very bad decisions with her life, having lied to all of the people who love her. And so it leaves her in a place where she has a lot she needs to atone for, a lot of people she needs to apologize to. So we pick back up with her 6 years later during the Great Depression. She has come back to Virginia. She's now got two small children, and she's married. And so it was sort of a treat as an author to be able to kind of go back and correct some mistakes that your character has made, or to begin a novel where you already know one of the characters very well. And I didn't intend for this book to be a dual narrative, for In All Good Faith to be a dual narrative. I intended to just continue May's story, but this second character kept sort of bouncing around in my head, and I had never had that experience, but this 16-year-old girl from Boston sort of popped into my head, and as I continued to research the plot and found out about the Veterans Bonus March, her whole story sort of plausibly fell into place of where she would have a place in the story, and I knew I had to tell both stories.
And I'm so glad that you do. And one of the things I appreciate about the novel is how, at least for the most part, we are toggling back and forth between the life of May and the life of this young girl from the Sykes family. Dorrit, is that how pronounce her name? And it makes for a very engaging read. Did you write this novel in a sense in kind of consecutive fashion, or did you craft the chapters for May and then the chapters for Dorrit, or shuffle them later? I mean, I'm just kind of curious how this binary novel took shape.
Yes, I had never attempted a dual narrative before. And the rule of thumb is that the story has to continue moving forward, no matter whose head you're in. So I started out trying to write strictly one chapter in May's point of view, one chapter in Dorrit's point of view. And and I was getting sort of stifled. So I ended up writing chunks of or sections in one character's point of view and another's, and then splicing them, making sure that time was continuing to move forward. And then the tricky parts are when you have them, once they meet and they're in the same room together, you have to, the writer has to decide whose head is the scene going to be played from, whose head am I going to be in, and you can actually write the same scene twice from the two different characters' perspectives because they're vastly different. And when you're looking at one character through another character's eyes, you can observe a lot of things that you might not otherwise. But Dorrit's name, you asked about her name. When she came into my head, I knew that there was something sort of Dickensian about her. She had some sort of a tragedy in her background. So I named her from a combination of two of Charles Dickens' characters, from Little Dorrit and from Oliver Twist.
Ah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Liza Nash Taylor about her latest novel called In All Good Faith, which is, as she characterized just a couple of minutes ago, a standalone sequel to a previous novel called Etiquette for Runaways. And we follow the lives of two different women, Mae Marshall and a much younger woman, really a girl, Dorrit Sykes, as they make their way through all kinds of pain and difficulty in 1931 and 32, which of course is during the Great Depression, that was such a brutal period in our country's life, and brutal on so many different levels. I think one of the things that I took away from your novel, which I had never really stopped to think about, was how the Great Depression inflicted so much pain on, in a sense, all strata of American society. I mean, if you were kind of living a hand-to-mouth existence already, and then the Great Depression comes, I mean, it was devastating. But in perhaps different ways, but in no less significant ways, it was really equally devastating to those, many at least, who had a lot of money, and then suddenly that money was gone. Can you just say a little bit more about giving us, in a sense, a couple of different perspectives on the devastation wrought by the Great Depression?
Yes, sure. Well, for instance, the Sykes family, Dorrit's family, they live in a tenement in Boston. Her father is an itinerant mechanic. She and her mother take in sewing. So the financial crash of 1929 didn't affect them in that they didn't own a house. They didn't have investments. What might have happened would be that people would have less sewing work, or maybe even more sewing work, because they'd be buying fewer new clothes, and so having their older clothes mended. And then from May's point of view, in Keswick, Virginia, she lives on a farm, so they have chickens and vegetables, I mean, if worse comes to worse. But her husband's family loses a great fortune. And so there's sort of a big reset there socially, economically. This filters down into her marriage and her relationship with her husband, because all of a sudden his status has changed so much. He has to change jobs. So it did affect people on different levels. I recently read Kristen Hannah's novel, The Four Winds, which deals with a mother in the Dust Bowl in Texas, and then she goes to California during the Depression, and that is a much more dire tale of, you know, starvation and people losing their homesteads and displaced sharecroppers. So there were definitely degrees. I also just reread John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, which is such a fabulous American tragedy, and that's also very dire about this period.
Right. I mean, for instance, May's husband, Bird, is a lawyer. And by the time we get to 1931 and 1932, almost all of his work has dried up. I mean, his work as a lawyer. I mean, he's down to just handling a few foreclosures and that sort of thing. But His law practice is nothing like what he had imagined it would be, and it ultimately evaporates into nearly nothing. And I don't think when most of us think back to the Great Depression, think about the plight of, for instance, lawyers. but even somebody in a position like that found much of the life they had known completely destroyed.
Yes, that's right. And people, you know, who had worked hard and saved their money, all you know, their bank went under, and they would lose all of their savings or their homes, and they through no fault of their own. So, it's hard for us to imagine today a circumstance where those things could be happening to our friends and neighbors.
Right, and I think that's something else that is so interesting about your novel is it sort of ushers us into sort of different chambers of pain that we would not think about. That, for instance, we might more immediately think about the person who can scarcely afford to buy their groceries to feed their family. We don't think quite as much about the person standing behind the counter of that store and the pain that they would feel. I want to read, if you don't mind, just a brief moment that I think is so interesting. So this is a point when May has returned to Virginia, to the family business, helping out her father. And I just want to read this one paragraph and then have you expand on it. Times were hard all over, not only in Virginia. Drought, insects, and tree blight had decimated the orchards at Keswick Farm and threatened the closing of the canning operation that had operated since 1849. At the market, the stack of unpaid credit slips from customers grew higher each month, and May asked her father, how could they deny milk to the children of neighbors? And he would answer that those very neighbors sent their children in for groceries because they were too ashamed to confront the debt they knew they would not pay. How, Henry Marshall asked, could they continue to feed the hungry wanderers who knocked at the back door? May would answer, those poor men might be out of work through no fault of their own. Then a cyclical argument would begin where father and daughter inevitably ended up pressing the same all too familiar points. It had become almost comical. In humanitarian terms, May knew she was right. From a practical standpoint, her father was. But he didn't have to face those poor men every day and see their shame. Shame was something that May Craig knew about. She had become adept at keeping it at bay. There's just such a rich human drama playing out there in terms of how one makes their way through the world under circumstances like this. Anything you want to add?
Well, Greg, you read really beautifully. You just read that so beautifully. It was true. A lot of May's story in the first book has to do with shame. Shame is a theme of that book. And certainly the people who were during the Great Depression called bums and hobos, and I don't mean those terms as slurs, that's what they were called then. These were people who had jobs or worked on a railroad or, we don't know what any of their backgrounds were, but now they've been wandering and homeless and their clothes are ragged and maybe they smell bad, you know. It was just a terrible, terrible time.
Hmm. We should talk about the young woman Dorrit Sykes, and there are a couple of themes woven into her own story, and one of them is that she has some kind of trouble with anxiety attacks or panic attacks or nervous attacks. When we first learn about Dorrit, she's posing to herself the question, God, what is wrong with me? Sometimes it was an invisible feather, a wisp skimming the back of her neck. Sometimes it was a spindle winding tight inside her chest until she breathed like a cornered rabbit. And sometimes, the worst times, fear was a thing with teeth and claws. It rode on streetcars and hid in movie theaters. It came to church and sat down beside her. You're describing Dorrit's problems with anxiety, and we feel for her as you tell us more about her plight. Did you have to, in a sense, research this whole matter of anxiety attacks and how they tend to manifest themselves? And were you drawing on perhaps any personal experience?
Yes, Greg. It's very personal for me. I've suffered anxiety issues since my early teens. So the description you just read is something that I draw from personally. But I did also do quite a bit of medical research, mainly on how this problem was addressed in the early 30s. And I also researched how other things were treated, diphtheria and anything during that era. And what I did with both of my novels is I sent a list of questions to my family doctor, and he has a lot of fun helping me with my research. And he loaned me a 1934 physician's desk reference called The Modern Home Physician, edited by the very aptly named Dr. Wise. And that was my sole source for treatment and popular medical opinions for 1932. So there's a section in the book on mental disease and anxiety that were really very interesting. The category of mental disease has three pages of small print, and according to Dr. Wise, heredity, state of bodily health, poverty, bad sanitary conditions increase the incidence. Sex is another important factor. To mate with a member of the opposite sex is the natural destiny of the sexually mature individual, and the frustration of this design may occasion mental disorder. The incidence of insanity is considerably greater among the unmarried. Insanity is also more common among those who have been widowed. So I have Dorrit going into the Boston Public Library on Boylston Street, which is her source of refuge and solace and beauty and learning. And she finds this medical text where she's trying to diagnose herself. She knows something's wrong. She wants to get better. And so she finds this book, and this is the information that it holds for her, which is confusing and doesn't answer any of her questions. So she sets out to really cure herself.
Another thing that is a complicating factor is the fact that she is in a household that practices Christian Science. And so this is a factor that makes her road ever so much more difficult. I wonder if it was difficult for you to weave this theme into the novel, especially because I think one could read about the presence of that theme in the book and really come away with some very negative feelings about Christian Science because it seems to inflict still more pain on this young woman. I'm just curious if you found that kind of a difficult aspect of the novel to handle.
Well, I was fascinated by Christian Science, which was founded by Mary Baker Eddy in 1879. And when I went to Boston, I had a tour of the Mother Church there. They were very welcoming. And then afterwards, I was able to talk to some of the scholars in the Mary Baker Eddy Library, and they answered my questions about birth practices and funerals. It's always been a controversial religion. And of course, there's nothing more personal than one's religious beliefs, and all religions have their zealots, and Dorrit's mother is very zealous in her beliefs, and when Dorrit tells her mother that she has anxiety, her mother just tells her to pray about it. And Dorrit is frustrated because prayer isn't making her better, and so that's what leads her to the library to finding a medical reason for her anxiety attacks. But, you know, Christian Science in Boston at that time was very popular. The church is still has an awful lot of followers, and it has political influence. You know, the Christian Science Monitor is still going strong.
Another factor that is an interesting aspect of Dorrit's life is her fascination with Nancy Drew mysteries. Pardon the pun, what drew you to include Nancy Drew in the story of Dorrit? How did you think that fit into what she was contending with?
Well, Nancy Drew, a lot of people think Nancy Drew started in the 1950s, but it actually began in 1930, and it was originated by the Hardy Boys publisher, Edward Straitmeyer, as a girl's version of the Hardy Boys adventures. And Carolyn Keene was a pen name he invented, and different authors wrote the series through the years. And, of course, over the years, Nancy's been edited and revised. In one of the original stories I read, her father loans her a loaded revolver to take with her on an investigation, and she's 16 years old. So Nancy Drew is new in 1930 when Dorrit is reading and spending all of her free time at the library. Nancy Drew is the coolest new girl on the block. And Dorrit identifies with her because Nancy has her own automobile. Nancy's also lost her mother, as Dorrit has. But Nancy is fearless. She goes on adventures. She solves mysteries. So she becomes sort of Dorrit's alter ego. And through the book, she kind of wonders, what would Nancy Drew do? And she can read Nancy Drew and have adventures without putting herself into threatening or triggering situations, actually. And then as we go through the book, and Dorrit really does go through some harrowing things, she sort of says, you know, Nancy Drew doesn't know anything. You know, she doesn't know about real life.
And I do.
Right.
Yeah, it's really, really wonderful. Well, ultimately, the lives of Mae Marshall and Dorrit Sykes cross. And one of the backdrops of their shared story is, of all things, candy. I know from the author's note that you have some fascination with candy. And of course, it's amazing to think about candy being made or purchased and consumed during that, you know, what we think of as just an unrelentingly bleak period in our history. But candy was there, and in some respects, candy played a very important role during the Depression. Tell us more about how it figures in that chapter of our history and ultimately in the story of these two women.
Yes, well, I love candy, and so that was a very fun part of the book to research. I read several books about the history of candy. And during the Depression, especially for people who were wayfarers who might not be able to cook and didn't have a home, a candy bar, a 5-cent candy bar, might be all they had for the day. And, you know, candy, chocolate candy bars, that kind of thing, they're very calorically dense. And so there was, and candy started to be marketed to being nutritious. There was a candy bar called Chicken Dinner. It didn't taste like a chicken dinner, but it was marketed as having the same nutritious value as a chicken dinner. And they actually would take trucks and retrofit them to look like a giant chicken and drive them around like an ice cream truck and sell these candy bars. So people ate candy. I think, you know, it was something you could put in your pocket and it cost a nickel. So that played into May's story of trying to revamp her family's business into something that was viable when the orchard crops were failing. How could they take the production space they had and make something that the public wanted and needed? And so that is a driving force for her. And I don't know how I came up with candy, actually. I think I came upon some of these advertisements for something like the chicken dinner candy bar, and I thought, where would that come from?
Right. And of course, it's just so intriguing to think about what people turn to when life is so difficult. And this is one of the things. And it's also what Mae Marshall turns to in terms of trying to keep the family afloat and to bring the family business into a new chapter that might actually allow it to thrive. One of my favorite lines in the whole novel is when Dorrit, who is thinking this, we all need something to call our own, something to dream about. And it is kind of the parallel need of following dreams and working towards them that propels these two characters into such a marvelous arc of drama. Ultimately, this book just plays out so beautifully. Again, it's called In All Good Faith. It's published by Blackstone Publishing and the author, Liza Nash Taylor. Liza Nash Taylor, thank you so much for writing such a wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. What a pleasure. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we go into the Morning Show archives for an interview that was recorded and originally broadcast back in 2017. I've had the great pleasure on two previous occasions of speaking with best-selling author Andrew Carroll. We have talked about his book, War Letters, and about another book called Operation Homecoming. His most recent book coincides with the 100th anniversary of America's entrance into the First World War, the so-called Great War. And Andrew Carroll's contribution to our reflection on this conflict and our part in it is a marvelous new book called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War. This book is intended to be a book that explores what was the personal experience of many who experienced this conflict from the front lines. And it makes use of extensive letters, including many by General John Pershing himself, never seen before. The book is published by Penguin Press. And Andrew Carroll, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
It's so good to talk to you again.
I'm really happy that we have this opportunity. I should also remind our listeners, for those who were able to see the marvelous American Experience documentary called The Great War, that you were one of the people who were involved in that. You were one of the experts whom we hear from in that marvelous film. Can you say a quick word about the way in which this particular conflict, the First World War, is somehow not as remembered as it really should be? I mean, perhaps more so in this anniversary year, but otherwise how somehow we have managed to forget this conflict, how important it was, and especially how terrible it was.
It really was eclipsed by World War II in particular. And one of the things that really drew me into it, because I frankly kind of counted myself among those who wasn't that fascinated in it. And then I started reading the letters of the young men and women, including those who served as war nurses or ambulance drivers, who were there as early as 1914, 1915. And then, of course, America officially got involved in 1917. But it was really coming across Pershing's story that got me so interested in the topic, because he'd always seemed like this statuesque figure and really forgotten in many ways, overshadowed by all the World War II generals like Eisenhower and Patton and MacArthur, many of whom served under him. Eisenhower never went over to Europe, but he was one of his mentees after the war. But Pershing is actually the highest-ranking general in American history, and he's the only general to essentially earn a sixth star in his lifetime. But what really drew me to his story was the loss of his family. When the war was going on, but a year before the Americans got involved, his wife and his three daughters were all killed in a house fire, and only his young boy Warren was pulled out alive. And it really, when I learned that, it just kind of humanized him. And I want to learn more about the war, and it just kind of made me realize how little I had appreciated what these troops had done, their sacrifices. And it was interesting because we did a panel with the Great War for the premiere, and it's being rebroadcast on PBS throughout the spring and the summer, and they really did a phenomenal job with it. And one of the panelists made the point that you could almost argue that World War I is more significant than World War II, not just because of the relation between the two conflicts, but the map that was left of World War I is very much influencing our day in the here and now, that Iraq and Syria and all these places were carved up in World War I, and other issues that we're grappling with in Europe and so forth are really in some ways echoes of that conflict. And so what I wanted to do with the My Fellow Soldiers book is to really make it appealing to the general reader, the person who thinks that they're really not going to be that interested in this topic, as I wasn't, but really kind of show them what a compelling story it is and just how many young Americans sacrificed their lives and fought and bled and waged war for this nation.
I should have asked you this question before we went on the air. I wonder if it would be okay if we explained to the listeners how your foreword begins, or would you rather leave that as a surprise when they read the book?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I would rather leave it as a surprise, but I will say this, and this will give a bit of a hint, that this book is really part of a much larger project that goes back to when we first spoke about war letters, more than 15 years ago. And then it's ongoing to preserve American war correspondences. And so I started this project. It began all volunteer, and it's nationwide. And it's to encourage Americans to seek out and to preserve letters from the Revolution all the way up to emails from Iraq and Afghanistan. And the easiest way for people to learn about this larger campaign, which I'm very passionate about, is just go to our website, warletters.us. So we focus on war letters, and we're American, so it's warletters.us. And it'll give people a better idea of what we're looking for. And I'm barnstorming the country over the next couple months, speaking at American Legion posts, as I am in Milwaukee. People can see my schedule on there. But going to all sorts of venues to really encourage people, look in your attics, your basements, your closets. You might have something that's really extraordinary. And veterans are very modest about what they've written. So I'm trying to encourage them, share what you have. And it's just incredible what people are showing to us. And so the book was sort of inspired by letters that had not been seen before and things that people have shared with me, and that really becomes, I think, the heart and soul of the book.
It really is. Explain, in a sense, what this book is not.
I love that question. It is not a history textbook about World War I. This is a very personal look through, the letters and the journals of those who served, not my personal perspective, but it's a very intimate look at what the war was like. And I really found these extraordinary characters like Victor Chapman, who is the first, one of the great first combat pilots, and Eugene Bullard, the first African-American combat pilot, and then a young Patton, a young Truman, a young MacArthur, what they all went through. And so I really, again, I didn't want this to seem like an academic study. This is almost, I wanted it to read almost like a novel where you follow these characters, but every word is true. Every word comes from what they expressed or wrote or put in a journal. And so it really is, I think, kind of an eyewitness perspective of what it was like to go through that war, in which for the first time we see machine guns and gas and tanks and submarines. So it really was a revolutionary time. Mm-hmm.
We are speaking with Andrew Carroll about his book, My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War. One of the things you tell us is that in many of the letters and journals that you explored, particularly in those of someone by the name of Alan Seeger, you say one topic dominated almost everything else: the trenches. Life in the trenches was an immediate and overwhelming assault on the senses. Tell our listeners, because this is such a central part of how war was fought in this particular conflict, what life in the trenches literally was like for the soldiers unfortunate to enough to experience it firsthand.
Well, I don't want to get too graphic, and I'm sure you don't want me to either, so a lot of that's in the book, but definitely, yes. I mean, let me see how I can do this in a discreet way. The smells that you encountered, because you know there were corpses in no man's land that you know during the summer months were just left there and were just horrifying to men relieving themselves in the trenches because there was nowhere else to go. To of course the violence of you could get hit by machine gun fire or a shell lobbing over, and sometimes even by your own shells because the artillery on your side aimed too short. So it was kind of this never-ending stress and tension. And there were even one thing I didn't know about. There were bomb makers who tunneled under the trenches. The enemy would tunnel under you and pack it with explosives, and you would suddenly see this explosion coming up from underneath. And so I described that from a guy who witnessed something. He wasn't underneath it. I'm sorry, he wasn't over it himself, but he was some distance away for another of his trenches that was blown up. And it was just this never-ending terror. And that's one of the things I really wanted to convey to the reader, of just how horrifying this experience was, and really to give us all a better sense of what they went through.
One of the other themes that we sense from some letters is the evolution of attitude in terms of what this conflict was about and what it was like to for a given soldier to fight in it. I think of one particular soldier by the last name of he was nicknamed Champy.
Yep.
And you tell us at one point, as the realities of a soldier's life sank in, Champy's letters became more and more laced with ambivalence and regret. How common was this? How often do we see this in the letters of soldiers who fought in World War One? This, in a sense, eroding morale as the war dragged on.
Well, it definitely ebbed and flowed. And what's interesting about Champy, and I'm glad you brought him up because he's a really fascinating character. He was born in France, moved to America, fell in love with the country, became an American citizen, and then when the war started, he went back to France to fight with his original country. And he kind of thought that his friends and family would think less of him if he didn't volunteer. And quite the opposite. They thought he was foolish because he was very well educated and he wanted to be just, the average infantryman. He didn't want to be an officer. And life was just miserable for them. And he was sort of shocked that people actually were like, why would you ever go and do this? And so here he was risking his life. And I think I'll let the reader find out what happens to him. But it was a really intriguing story. And he's often called the first American, although, again, he was French-born, to be killed in the war. And that's not quite correct. I actually found an American who was killed earlier. And in Chicago, where his childhood home was, we're going to put up a plaque in his honor. But Champy wrote these very compelling letters about his experiences. And I think what he expressed in Seeger and other troops was a kind of fatality. And Seeger, of course, wrote the famous poem, I Have a Rendezvous with Death. And, it was a sense of, if you're going to get killed, it's going to happen. And that was something that was very pervasive in the letters, that just the sense of uncontrollableness, that there was no way of knowing when your number was going to come up, but there was nothing you could do about it. And it's kind of the only way to deal with the threat of death, which is almost kind of just sort of, relinquishing that notion that you have any sort of control. So that's what, to me, really came through the letters from so many different troops, from so many different backgrounds.
It's interesting. A single soldier writing about their own experience is, of course, in a sense, writing about a very narrow slice of what was, for instance, going on. I mean, they know what's going on in the trench in which they are trapped, or the particular group of soldiers with which they are stationed. So in one respect, we are not given the whole picture, and yet cumulatively, these letters provide us with an extraordinarily rich and broad portrait of this conflict and of what it was like to fight it.
Well, I think you've really touched on the key thing I wanted to get across, is that there's almost a kaleidoscope effect, that when you see these all these different perspectives, it gives you, as you said, a much richer view of what all these people were experiencing, whether it's in the general's headquarters. And again, I have, you know, the original journals and letters that they wrote, where they're telling about the conversations they're having and the battles that they're fighting, even amongst themselves, about whether American troops are going to be used in this place or that place, and when and how and so forth, down to the trench perspective, or the literally the pilot's perspective. We have these beautiful letters by American pilots describing being up in the air, and how Quentin Roosevelt, who was Theodore Roosevelt's son, had a very, I thought, sort of amusing line, because it was freezing up there. These were open cockpits. These were the original warplanes. And he said, I don't know how the angels stand it. It's just so cold up here, and it's changed my view on religion. And there's actually a very poignant exchange between General Pershing and Theodore Roosevelt when Quentin is shot down, because Pershing had experienced, you know, great family loss, as T.R. did. And, you know, and I don't want to give the impression that everything in the book is depressing and miserable. There's a beautiful love story in the book, and in fact, I came across essentially the last letter that Pershing wrote to the woman he eventually married, and it's one of the most beautiful love letters I've ever read in my life, and I think really shows a different side of him too. So it really gives you all these different facets of the human experience in times of war, and I think that they're really universal, that you know, even though the trench warfare was very unique to World War One, just, you know, what you go through, whether it's in the jungles of Vietnam or in, you know, villages in Iraq when the Marines are fighting door-to-door in Fallujah, that experience of being under fire, of risking your life, really is timeless.
Absolutely. Well, and as somebody said in one of their own letters, death could come from any direction. And
literally.
And yep. Yes, and that is a reality that most of us can't begin to imagine.
Yeah, and I really wish that, you know, we had greater admiration for this generation of soldiers, because, you know, there was no Pearl Harbor-like attack that caused America to get involved in the war. So there wasn't that sense of, that, you know, of retribution or revenge. They really kind of went in on principle. They felt that what the Germans were doing to the Belgians and the French and so forth really had to be stopped. And so, to me, in that sense, there's a great nobility in the World War One generation. And I think, again, they've been sort of eclipsed. There's no national memorial on here in Washington, D.C., where I'm from, on the Mall for World War One. And there's a beautiful memorial in Kansas City, and very much, you know, the national memorial. But, again, on the National Mall, with all these other incredible memorials, there's nothing for World War One. And that, to me, I think, is an indication of how this generation has been overlooked and deserves more attention.
Well, your marvelous book is certainly part of that effort. The book, again, is called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War, published by Penguin Press, the author, Andrew Carroll. Andrew Carroll, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and more importantly, thank you for writing this very important book.
Thank you. And again, I just want to encourage your listeners, warletters.us, that's what we're really passionate about. Obviously, we want to, you know, I love the book, but the overall project is what's most meaningful. So thank you so much for helping us spread the word.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, and a member of the Gateway Board of Trustees. We'll be along with President Albrecht to talk about this upcoming new school year. Wednesday, an interview that was originally slated to air last Wednesday, but we were knocked off the air because of a power outage. So it will be Wednesday that you'll finally hear from John Seeger, who is chief executive of a nonprofit, nonpartisan group called Population Connection, which works towards the goal of what they like to call population stability, drawing attention to the factor of overpopulation in terms of the planet's well-being, and also the well-being of individual people. And an interesting group doing laudable work. We'll talk about that on Wednesday. On Thursday, I'm very pleased to be able to welcome back to the morning show Carla Nivocosi, who is Director of Public Health in Walworth County. We'll be getting a COVID-19 update from him, and he'll help us understand new announcements regarding vaccinations, the Delta variant, and so on. That will be Thursday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and the program is available as a podcast 7 days a week. Subscribe to The Morning Show with Greg Burr.